This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 30th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 424. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, Mark Carney started 2025 as Brookfield's chairman. He is ending the year as Canada's prime minister. But questions remain about the breadth and the depth of his conflicts of interest. This week's guest is Duff Conacher, co-founder of Democracy Watch, who also discusses his quest to hold Justin Trudeau accountable for the SNC-Lavalin scandal, and the BC NDP's cost to taxpayers for defending the 2020 violation of BC's fixed election date law.
This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast.
One of the biggest stories of the year was, of course, the replacement of Justin Trudeau as prime minister with Mark Carney. And Mark Carney is a prime minister like no other, a former central banker and corporate board chair. He was on the boards of Brookfield, Bloomberg, and he also amassed quite a big investment portfolio over the years. Now, before the election, he said he put his investments in a blind trust. He said he was following the rules. And after the election, we got to see what was actually inside. So voters didn't get a full picture of who Mark Carney was when they went to the polls back at the end of April. Meanwhile, Carney is now, as prime minister, spending billions of dollars in infrastructure projects, making multi-billion dollar promises. The latest today, on November 27th, is a agreement with the premier of Alberta, Danielle Smith, to get Alberta Oil to the west coast of BC to get another pipeline happening. The devil's in the details, of course. They need investors. So last week, Brookfield's chief operating officer appeared before a House of Commons ethics committee to answer questions about Mark Carney and his conflicts of interest, real and apparent and perceived. Now, his name is Justin Bieber, no relation, different spelling from the pop star. But what stood out for you from this hearing, Duff, about Brookfield Asset Management, about Prime Minister Mark Carney's background, about what he still holds in this quote-unquote blind trust, and the concerns of the politicians who asked the questions at this hearing?
The Privy Council clerk, essentially the cabinet clerk, Michael Sabia, testified, as did the Prime Minister Mark Carney's chief of staff, Marc-André Blanchard. And when you add it all up, there wasn't really news, but unfortunately the media has really... almost every media outlet has inaccurately reported how blind trust and ethics screens work. And so out of this came some details that even the media couldn't ignore. There was some finally accurate reporting about the state of things. First thing is, it's not a blind trust. Okay, Mark Carney owns stock options, is what they're called. It means he owns shares in the company that he can't sell for years. And he owns those in both Brookfield Corporation and Brookfield Asset Management. And those are big conglomerates that own 2,000 other companies. And so he has an ongoing, significant financial conflict of interest. He knows he owns those stock options. He knows they can't be sold for years. In addition, of course, he chose the trustee for his so-called blind trust, which again is not blind. And he also is able to give the trustee instructions initially. So even with all the shares he owns in 550 other companies, he could have said, don't sell anything. And the trustee's allowed to give him regular updates about the value of his investments in the trust, which would give him some indication about whether he's making decisions that he's profiting from, or decisions that are hurting those businesses. So it's not a blind trust, and he knows he owns these shares in Brookfield. Two, the ethics screen that he set up is a smoke screen, and it was just confirmed that it was a smoke screen. While the Prime Minister's office and the cabinet clerk cabinet office are tracking big files that are coming out of departments and saying, oh, he can't be involved in those files because they affect the Brookfield companies or those 103 other companies in that are covered by the screen. What they're not doing is they're not screening phone calls that he initiates, texts, email, online calls, other communications, conversations that he's having with people when he's traveling abroad. None of that is being screened by anyone except Mark Carney himself. So he's not being kept away from participating in discussions, decisions, and votes that affect the companies he's invested in. And even when they affect the companies in very specific ways. All he's been screened out of are these big files. And then if a lobbyist wants to meet from him from one of these companies, they won't let the lobbyist meet with them or communicate with them. But what's also happening is those people, those lobbyists are still communicating with PMO staff more than 170 times in the last 5 months. And of course, then the staff can easily pass on to Mark Carney what the lobbyist wants. Beyond that, it was also confirmed that the screen does not apply when a decision that cabinet's making or Carney's involved in or a discussion is about something that applies generally to Brookfield and a whole bunch of other companies. And as long as that's the case, he's allowed to participate. So he knows that he has investments in Brookfield, no blind trust. He's allowed to participate in decisions that affect Brookfield and the companies, 2,000 companies under the Brookfield conglomerate, under his screen. And as a result, and he's allowed to do that all the secret, he doesn't have to disclose when he is participating in decisions that he could profit from. And so he's allowed to secretly profit from decisions and that he participates in as the prime minister. It's all a charade, it's all a sham. Hopefully the media will from now on report that accurately, because that is the facts.
I kind of jokingly call the blind trust as it's constituted federally as an eyes wide shut trust. And to that, we saw on Grey Cup Sunday, Mark Carney attended the game in Winnipeg, and he was there for the Grey Cup coin toss at the start of the game. That was sponsored by Coinbase, and I looked it up pretty quickly, and his list of all his investments includes shares in Coinbase, which is a cryptocurrency company.
One of many ongoing, significant, direct financial conflicts of interest that he is in. He is literally a walking, talking financial conflict of interest. Very serious, very unethical, and he doesn't seem to care, and nobody in the prime minister's office or cabinet office seems to care either.
There's got to be someone out there who's going to, you know, throw the flag and penalize him for promoting one of his investments in such a public way at one of the biggest sporting events of the year in Canada, one of the biggest TV audiences of the year in Canada, promoting actively one of his investments there by flipping the coin at the Grey Cup of all things. That really did surprise me.
Yeah, and Conrad von Finkenstein, the current ethics commissioner, who in the first 6 months of his office buried 8 ethics complaints about Trudeau cabinet ministers and also weakened the ethics rules by interpreting them in weak ways in 3 different areas. I mean, this guy has said and made it very clear in his testimony before the House Ethics Committee that he is dedicated to facilitating big business, wealthy people getting into politics. And he's not interested in preventing, prohibiting, or penalizing conflicts of interest. The law itself is really the almost impossible to be in a conflict of interest act. It shouldn't be called the Conflict of Interest Act because it has this huge loophole where you can participate in decisions that apply generally, even if you have a financial conflict of interest and can profit from the decision. And 99% of decisions that the cabinet makes and the prime minister makes apply generally. So the act does not apply 99% of the time. So we have a law that's really just a loophole more than a law. An ethics commissioner who's not trying to uphold ethics standards. And a prime minister who has these financial, is a walking, talking financial conflict interest and doesn't care. And no one around him cares about that.
Now, Justin Bieber, the chief operating officer of Brookfield, told the House of Commons committee that the only time he's talked to Mark Carney since he became prime minister was in October, and it was a meeting to express his concern about the rise of anti-Semitism in Canada. Now, that's an important topic, of course. He said he didn't talk business. He didn't lobby him on Brookfield.
I'm here to tell you that no one at Brookfield has communicated with the prime minister in relation to Brookfield or its business. That's what we're required to monitor. That's what I'm here to confirm.
Do you find that believable?
He may not have, but just the fact that he calls up and gets a meeting with the prime minister as just an individual. He didn't say he was representing any organization that represents thousands of voters. Oh, I'm your one of your old colleagues from this company you're invested in. I want to talk to you about something. And what does Carney do? Rolls over and gives him a meeting. That's a corrupt system. It's not ethical. If George Ain Average voter called and said, I want to talk to you about an issue, they're not going to get a meeting in the prime minister's office from Carney. So that alone is preferential treatment for a Brookfield executive. And it's based on Carney's past relationship and ongoing financial investments in Brookfield. And that's an unethical system. It's not democratic, it's not ethical, and just shows how little Carney cares about maintaining high ethical standards. He has as many conflicts of interest, financial conflicts of interest, as Donald Trump. And Canada's media has spent far more time covering Donald Trump's financial conflicts of interest and how he could be profiting from decisions he's making as president than it has covered Mark Carney, our prime minister. Canadian media, you would think, would be focused on our prime minister and his financial conflicts of interest. And really, it's hypocrisy from mainstream media outlets in Canada that they spend so much attention on Trump and his profiting from his position, and really has not even reported accurately that Carney is a walking, talking financial conflict of interest, let alone focused on how he could be profiting from the decisions he's making as our prime minister.
He has been touring the country, making all sorts of announcements, greenlighting all sorts of multi-billion dollar infrastructure projects, making promises for others. One of the companies that sees an opportunity in this is a notorious company. Today it's called AtkinsRéalis. It used to be called SNC-Lavalin. People will remember the years and years of headlines about corruption in this company out of Quebec that had, it still operates projects that it built, such as the Canada Line here in Vancouver. It's got projects around the world. It got in trouble mostly for its projects offshore in Libya and other places. But you have been keeping this file alive by trying to get Justin Trudeau accountable in court on a private prosecution because of the way he handled this file when Jody Wilson-Raybould was the attorney general, and he interfered to try to get her to go light on SNC-Lavalin to stop the criminal prosecution. She did it by the book. She did it the way it should have been done, and resisted that interference from Prime Minister Trudeau, and she paid the political price for that. Now, you have done a great job in accessing thousands of documents, some of them redacted, some not, about SNC-Lavalin and the RCMP investigation and the shortfalls of the RCMP investigation. And you took that into a private prosecution. You filed that in court. Where is that standing today?
What happened was that the Ontario Crown Prosecutor, because we filed this in Ontario court, and an Ontario Crown Prosecutor decided that, in his opinion, we would not be able to prove criminal intent in terms of Justin Trudeau intending to stop the prosecution of SNC-Lavalin. And he has refused, his name's John Corelli, and he has refused to explain what he means by criminal intent. We tried to get the Deputy Attorney General in Ontario force an explanation out, and they're just sticking with criminal intent. We saw this in the RCMP documents, these words as well. The RCMP initially started out saying what is factual, that the Supreme Court of Canada's standard for obstruction of justice, trying to stop a prosecution, is you just have to show that they did it willfully, that it wasn't like some accidental, unintended consequence of some actions. And there was ample evidence that Justin Trudeau willfully, multiple times, about a dozen times, tried to get Jody Wilson-Raybould, either directly or through her staff, to stop, intervene and stop the prosecution of SNC-Lavalin. What the RCMP does later on in its investigation is it changes the standard to that it has to be criminal intent. And what most people, including the lawyer representing us, who knows criminal law, take that to mean is that you have to have wrongful or deceitful intent. Not just that you're trying to do it, but you're trying to do it wrongfully and in a deceitful way. Which also, there's lots of evidence that Trudeau did that wrongfully and deceitfully. He was found guilty by the ethics commissioner of violating the federal government ethics law for doing it. So isn't that wrongful, deceitful? But that's not the actual standard. The actual standard is you just have to show intent, that he did it intentionally. And the Crown Prosecutor used the same words that the RCMP did, criminal intent. And so we assume that that means he was looking for wrongful, deceitful intent. He doesn't have to, so he's made this wrong decision. We went back to the Ontario's Attorney General and did what we did initially, asked for a special prosecutor who's fully independent from all the parties in Ontario, not politically tainted, not under the Attorney General of Ontario, who's from, of course, the ruling party Conservatives, because we wanted it to be a fully independent decision that would be made. And that's what's often done in BC. Special prosecutors are appointed outside of the government to review these kind of cases involving politicians or government officials. And they refused, and now we have this decision, and we can't do anything about it. You can challenge a malicious prosecution in court, but you can't challenge a prosecutor for failing to prosecute someone unless you can show that they did that wrongfully, like that for some corrupt reason. And we don't have that evidence. We just think that they're using the wrong standard. So it's over, unfortunately, in terms of that. We're looking to file a private prosecution about Justin Trudeau accepting the trips from the Aga Khan for himself, his family, and friends to the Bahamas, which we think even more clearly violates the criminal code. And we're just raising funds to do that private prosecution, and we'll see what they do with that one. But it's very unfortunate. Essentially, the message from prosecutors, from the RCMP, from their internal lawyers, is there is no rule of law when it comes to powerful people in Canada. It's the Canadian way. If you walk away from your job or enough time has been passed, first of all, the RCMP usually tries to delay and suppress information about these investigations, hoping everyone just goes on their merry way and stops paying attention, which most of the media did. And we just kept digging and didn't let them get away with that. But in the end, if you're a powerful politician, government official in Canada, you just won't get prosecuted for corruption. That's the case. And the Supreme Court of Canada has ruled in a few cases that if we don't have a rule of law, which we don't, because if you're powerful enough, you'll get away with it, that means we're not a democracy. So there's many signs we're not really a functioning democracy. And that's one of the big ones in this situation that's been revealed.
And speaking of functioning democracy, Democracy Watch and Wayne Crooks, the founder of Integrity BC, went to court back in the fall of 2020 when John Horgan decided to call a snap election right in the middle of the pandemic. There wasn't a vaccine ready yet. It was in the pandemic. People were weakened and out of work, and businesses having all sorts of problems. But John Horgan thought it'd be a good time to have an election, and it worked out for him. He got a 57-seat majority. But Democracy Watch and Integrity BC founder Wayne Crooks went to court to contest the calling of the election. It shouldn't have been called based on the fixed election date law. BC Supreme Court judge and followed up by a Court of Appeal tribunal affirmed the decision that the government had the right to do this because the lieutenant governor can call an election whenever he or she sees fit, despite the fixed election date law. I tried, and it took me a while, to find out how much it cost for the government to use taxpayers' money to send BC government lawyers to BC Supreme Court and to the BC Court of Appeal. I finally got the answer through the Freedom of Information Adjudication System. The government fought me on this. They could have just given me the number, but they wanted to spend more money. And I finally got it. So almost $71,000 of legal bills of taxpayers' money that benefited John Horgan at the time, who eventually handed over the reins of government to David Eby in 2022. What are your thoughts on this, the government used that money to benefit a political party and its friends instead of the political party repaying the public treasury?
Well, they're defending a decision made as premier. You could make the case, though, that it was a decision made in favor of one party only. It violated also a legislative agreement that the NDP had with the Green Party, which is part of the evidence we put forward. And the opposition parties didn't want an election at the time. So it also violates the rights of MLAs in the legislature and the right of the legislature as it's overall, which the legislatures are what are sovereign and all powerful in our system. They direct the government what to do, not the other way around. And unfortunately, the court rolled over and allowed it. And yeah, I think you can make the case, like we've made the case in the situation federally with Pierre Poilievre and losing his election and his seat and then having a conservative MP resign and run in a by-election, that the party should have to pay for the costs of that by-election because it's only in their interests. So I think you can make the case that parties should be, with these kind of self-interested decisions, paying the costs of them. Unfortunately, the court rules don't allow for that. We actually won our case in New Brunswick, where the law said something a bit differently. It said the premier shall not go to the lieutenant governor of that province and call an election other than on the fixed election date. And because of that specificity in the actual law, that meant that the court could say, well, it says the premier can't do this. And so we can have fixed election dates across the country just by putting that language in. When we won that case in New Brunswick, unanimous ruling from the New Brunswick Court of Appeal, the New Brunswick government, still headed by the same premier who had called the snap election, Blaine Higgs, he introduced a bill to take that measure out of the law so that the election date's fixed, but it doesn't say that the premier shall only call an election on the fixed election date. So premiers across the country, the prime minister, they've all ignored these fixed election measures where they have them, and they want this discretion as the head of the ruling party to call an election when it favors their party. And it's, again, unethical, undemocratic. And so whenever you hear a politician say, oh, I don't understand why the polls show that so few people trust us. Well, because you always act in your self-interest. You know, just like the ethics law with Carney that's full of loopholes. Now, right now, the Liberals are resisting closing those loopholes when the House Ethics Committee is reviewing the law. Snap elections, secret unethical lobbying is legal. Excessive secrecy is legal. The political finance system is essentially a legalized bribery system. And all the parties know this and maintain it all because it's in the self-interest of themselves, the party leaders and the parties. And it's not in the public interest. It's not democratic or ethical, transparent, honest. And that's why only 10 to 20% in surveys over the last 10, 15 years show that only 10 to 20% of voters actually trust politicians. And why would you trust someone who's always acting in their self-interest instead of the public interest? So we keep chipping away, trying to clean this stuff up, including trying to get fixed election dates and stop these unfair snap elections across the country.
Now, David Eby resisted calls from his own party to call a snap election. He stuck to the calendar. He took over from John Horgan halfway through John Horgan's mandate in 2022 and decided to stick with the fixed election date in October of 2024, which he did. And here we are in 2025, one of the big NDP controversies, because the NDP stayed in power and kept its friends and insiders, patronage appointees, on the boards at BC Ferries. BC Ferries made a very controversial decision announced in June to buy ferries from four new ferries from a shipyard in China, state-owned shipyard in China, CMI Weihai Shipyard. And shortly after that, we found out that there was a $1 billion federal loan that basically was the lever of that deal that made the deal happen. And we're still trying to find out what happened, how this happened, who the other bidders were, how this deal was really structured, why Canadian shipyards on East Coast and West Coast, which wanted the business, and we're going to find a way to do the business, why they were excluded. If this really just was about cost, was there any lobbying on behalf of the Chinese shipyard? We still just don't know. I'm trying to get the information. There's a key document that I got that was almost fully redacted, the decision paper from the CEO of BC Ferries to recommend this company. All the key information is taken out of there, so we don't know what's going on. The contract, they won't give me even a redacted version of the contract. They withheld the entire thing. Both of those files are in the hands of the Information Privacy Commissioner's Office here in BC. So I have complaints. There are investigations, and I suspect it'll go to an inquiry. I'm hoping it'll be expedited because the public has a right to know before this gets beyond the point of no return, to see the information, why the money was put at risk with a company in a country which is not our ally. What are your thoughts on this whole BC Ferries mess? Because the BC Ferries, the union of workers on BC Ferries, the building trades union here in BC, they've been very, very outspoken that this should have been kept in BC and British Columbia workers should be working on this project instead of being shipped overseas.
Yeah, this issue of value for money, the lowest price being the dominant factor, is just ridiculous. You know, there is a balancing. There are some things that we don't have the capacity to build in Canada, and there can be a balancing in those situations. But what really should be taken into account is the overall economic impact. Okay, so maybe you're saving money by buying ferries built in another country, but you're then going to have workers who will be on social welfare that you're paying for in here in Canada because they're unemployed. So if you're not taking that into account, you're not taking into account the overall real effective cost of having something built here at home versus abroad. Donald Trump and the trade tariffs have caused more awareness of this than ever before. Beyond that, in terms of the situation, again, just a situation where secrecy dominates, these loopholes in the Access Information Act and in BC, the Freedom of Information Act. Both of these laws should really be called the guide to hiding information that the public has a right to know, because that's what they are. The loopholes are vague, huge, proprietary information about a company can't be released. So the company claims everything's proprietary when it's not actually. Cabinet confidence, advice to cabinet, as it's also known, a gigantic loophole where they just essentially say you can't have anything that's going up to cabinet, when actually all that should be redacted is the actual advice, the final recommendation. But all the information that's going up to cabinet or to the heads of any other government institution should be disclosed. And then they have these vague things about economic security, something that affects a negotiation. But, you know, after someone signed a contract, handed it out, then negotiation's over. So everything should be released. And unfortunately, when you try to go to the commissioners, information commissioners across the country, in a lot of places, you can't even get a binding order to release the information. And then if they refuse to release it, which, for example, in Ontario, one of the ministries refused to release a bunch of information, even though there's a binding legal order. There's no penalty for doing that. So they just don't do it because there's no courts not going to throw a book at them. There's no fines that the commissioner can impose. So just another law that's key to democracy that is a sad joke, just like the ethics laws that allow for unethical decisions, profiting from your decisions secretly, the lobbying law that allows for secret unethical lobbying, the access to information, freedom of information laws allow for excessive secrecy. I mean, it's like we're living in an Orwellian world here. Unfortunately, these loopholes exist, and it's really hard to get effective accountability as a result. Everyone should just know they do exist, and all the parties know about them and have done nothing. They've known about them for 20 years across the country. We've been pointing them out, and they've done nothing. And so all these parties want power without accountability, and you shouldn't trust them as a result.
And speaking of high cost and high secrecy, the last topic I want to bounce off you is that if Canadians don't know already that the FIFA World Cup is coming to Canada, to Toronto and Vancouver specifically, in June and July next year, they will around December 5th. December 5th is the tournament draw. It's happening in Washington, D.C. Most of the tournament is happening in the United States, 11 cities, but there's 3 cities in Mexico and 2 in Canada that are also co-hosting this. Mark Carney will be traveling to Washington, D.C. to be part of this ceremony with FIFA. Again, it's high cost, high secrecy, as anything is with FIFA, also high risk. The spending here on the West Coast is approaching $1 billion. If you look at everything that's being spent to make this happen, approaching $1 billion. We got news this week that the price of the P&E Amphitheater, which will host the FIFA Fan Festival at Hastings Park, that's gone up again by about $46 million. It's tripled in price. It's on its way to $200 million. And of course, the NDP government back in June estimated that the cost of the tournament could be as high as $624 million. More federal money has been put in, and more money is probably going to be put in as we get closer to the tournament because it is such a complex event. Here we are, though, that tickets for people who want to go and who can afford to go, people are finding out the hard way that tickets are inaccessible or unaffordable. FIFA is trying to get the maximum profit out of this and is using a different system than previous World Cups. But the people that do have the inside track are politicians, like the politicians at Vancouver City Hall, where Mayor Ken Sim is a major soccer fan. Of course, the provincial government runs BC Play Stadium, and David Eby is the premier. We're probably going to see some stories about the purchase of VIP tickets. I know in Toronto, they budgeted about $10 million for VIP tickets. Here in Vancouver, it's about $13 million. Both city halls think that they can buy these tickets from the American supplier that has the FIFA deal and then resell them and perhaps make a profit to try to lower the cost to taxpayers of this tournament. That remains to be seen. They haven't shown their business plans to us. But, of course, the politicians will be enjoying this tournament and rubbing shoulders with famous people. What do you say to taxpayers who are concerned about this, and what should we be watching for as we get closer to the tournament?
First of all, the big overall issue for these kind of initiatives, any kind of big spending initiative, Mark Sawatch's proposal is that the government would have to go to, at the federal level, we have a parliamentary budget officer who can do a check on what the projected actual cost will be of this kind of spending. In provinces, the Auditor General could do it. And so that you would be stating the actual cost from the get-go, right? Because every single time with these boondoggles, it starts out with an estimate that ends up usually being 10 to 20% of the total cost. And the government tries to make it sound great because, hey, this is this huge thing and it's going to cost us a little bit of money. And then slowly it builds and builds. And they get away with it. They probably wouldn't get away with the spending in a lot of these situations if we knew the actual cost up front, because people would say, you got to be kidding. That's just not worth it. Secondly, as many studies have shown, these kind of sporting events usually cost more than they generate. They don't need to happen. People will come to a city and do things anyway and spend money in the city if they're not spending it on the sporting event. So when you subsidize a huge sporting event like this, all you're doing is taking people's money and sending it to the sporting event where it would go somewhere else. They would spend it in restaurants or on other things in the city, and the same number of tourists would likely come to the city. And so, again, you just end up with waste of taxpayers' money. Beyond that, yes, when we have an event like this, and any city holds an event like this, it's fine that one or two representatives from the government would go to the opening ceremonies. Sure. But after that, no, if you want to go to the game, pay for it yourself. Taxpayers should not be paying for any politician, their staff, their family members, VIPs they want to take along. Like, who are these people? Usually they end up being lobbyists who are trying to get things from the government. And you just have this trading of favors going on that's completely unethical. So yeah, at opening ceremonies, if there's only a few games in Toronto and Vancouver, then, you know, at the first game, they make an appearance and meet people from FIFA, from other countries, fine. But beyond that, no, pay for yourself. You're well paid as politicians and relatively to most of others. And this should not be a perk of your office. These are personal events. If you're personally interested in them, and pay for it with your own personal money.
Duff Conacher, the co-founder of Democracy Watch. Thanks again.
Thank you very much. And people can see much more about how the system really is the scandal. And that's why it's not surprising to see this kind of scandalous behavior that we've been talking about from politicians and public officials.
Podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Hong Kong Free Press, Tai Po fire death toll rises to 75 as Hong Kong leader promises 10,000 Hong Kong dollar handouts to all affected households. The Home and Youth Affairs Bureau has procured around 1,000 spots in hotels and youth hostels where residents can stay for around 1 to 2 weeks, Chief Executive John Lee said. The deadly fire started in one of the blocks on November 26th and quickly spread to others, engulfing 7 of the estate's 8 residential towers. Police arrested 3 from the construction company involved in the large-scale renovation work. In Taiwan news, Taiwan reaffirms role in regional peace at Halifax International Security Forum. Deputy Minister says Taiwan maintains peace through strength. Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs Chen Ming-Chi was a panelist for a discussion titled Artificial Advantages, China's Intelligent Approach. He also held talks and sideline meetings with lawmakers and other delegations, exchanging views on strengthening investment, supply chain cooperation, and democratic partnerships. Taiwan has been invited to the Halifax Conference every year since 2018. In ABC News Australia, social media age ban faces high court challenge as government declares it will not be bullied by legal threats. A digital freedom advocacy group and 2 representative young Australians have filed proceedings in the High Court challenging the incoming social media age ban. Their case will argue that the laws restrict the implied right to freedom of political communication. The federal government says it remains firm on implementing the social media ban next month, and it will not be intimidated by legal threats.
That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, a veteran lived in a car with his 250-pound pig for months. Portland first responders found them homes. In June 2025, a run of bad luck left the 44-year-old veteran Tony James without shelter in Portland after his appendix ruptured and left him unable to work his job as a sheet metal fabricator. A month later, his partner of 11 years died from a heart attack, leaving their dog Elvis and their pet pig Roscoe without a home. In Cascade PBS, why Washington voters swung left in the November elections. One local political analyst thinks affordability issues and frustration with the federal agenda on immigration and LGBTQ+ rights powered a progressive wave. Progressives won outright in the races for Seattle City Council and Seattle City Attorney, while most notably, progressive challenger Katie Wilson defeated incumbent Bruce Harrell to become Seattle's next mayor. Across the state, Democrats also won all 9 of the open seats in the state legislature. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. On Hump Day, a rare 1BC bill got over the hump. And exclusive, TheBreaker.news reveals how much taxpayers were billed to defend the NDP's 2020 election law breach. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to TheBreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.news podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't.
virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
Scots, who built British Columbia. It is St. Andrew's Day on November 30th. From James Douglas to John A. MacDonald to Jack Webster, the Scots that helped build British Columbia.
And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar? Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 30th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 30th of November in 1872, the first international soccer match between England and Scotland, it ended in a scoreless draw in Glasgow? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca and bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com.
Until next week.